we have a responsibility to speak up and to speak out, but to do it in a balanced and measured way.
A change at the top of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. We talked to the new president and several brother bishops about major challenges for the church in today's America.
This is maize, or some other region they call it corn. And in Ghana, it is one of the major staple food for the people.
We are in the African nation of Ghana to find out what some Catholic priests are doing to help improve the lives of the working poor who live in extreme poverty.
I'm a genre hopper, so I'll do a bluegrass song, and then I'll do a rock song, and then I'll do Gregorian chant, and then I'll do a pop song or a funk or a jazz song.
And music from a place of solitude. We visit a Catholic hermit in his recording studio who says God has inspired him to bring Christian music to the faithful. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
The bishops have a lot of concerns surrounding the immigration situation that we have today. But it's all rooted in our a love of neighbor and respect for the dignity of the human person.
A strong statement and show of solidarity this week. During their annual meeting in Baltimore, the U.S. bishops issued a special message, their first in more than a decade, centered around care for the immigrant. It's a response to the ever-evolving U.S. landscape as the Trump administration continues on their controversial efforts to curb illegal immigration. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. The annual fall meeting is a chance for the more than 200 bishops to shape and debate the priorities of the U.S. church, from the dignity and religious liberty of immigrants to electing new conference leadership. Mark Irons was there.
These men in black are on a mission. Successors of the apostles, they've been given a mandate from Christ to evangelize, to make disciples of all nations.
Pray for mercy, which we all need.
Going to make disciples. I mean, that's what the church needs to be about. And if we're faithful to that, that will transform the world.
That's the priority, said Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma City, elected by his brother bishops on Tuesday to be the new president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Can you give us a sort of state of the Catholic Church right now in America? Is the church having an impact on society?
I think the church is having a profound impact on society. I think our voice is respected. Our voice is often prophetic and countercultural.
And this week in Baltimore, it wasn't quite business as usual at the annual bishops' meeting.
The church cannot be silent.
For the first time in 12 years, the bishops invoked issuing a special message. The last time was in response to the contraceptive mandate under President Obama. This time, a response to the escalating and evolving immigration enforcement measures being implemented under the Trump administration.
I think there's a lot of concern.
The bishops wrote in part, "We are disturbed when we see among our people a climate of fear and anxiety around questions of profiling and immigration enforcement," adding, "We oppose the indiscriminate mass deportation of people." They also called for meaningful reform of immigration laws and procedures that would respect the dignity of immigrants and secure the nation. They said, "We recognize that nations have a responsibility to regulate their borders and establish a just and orderly immigration system for the sake of the common good." El Paso Bishop Mark Seitz, who leads the Bishop's Migration Committee, shared more with us.
We shouldn't have people who are committing criminal acts on our streets. Absolutely, no question about it. But we're also saying that the vast majority of those who have come here are not a burden on our country and not causing problems. On the contrary, they're people who contribute in multiple ways to the well-being of our country.
The special message did not explicitly mention the Trump administration, but it's clear the bishops would like to express their concerns not only on paper, but in person.
Is there a hope that President Trump would meet with the leadership of the bishops' conference now?
Absolutely.
Will he?
Oh, I mean, we've been asking for such a meeting for a long time.
There's also major concern over reports of some people being denied access to the sacraments and not receiving the Eucharist in immigrant detention centers.
That's an issue of religious liberty, the right to worship. One doesn't lose that right when one is detained, whether one is documented or undocumented. This is a fundamental right of the human person.
Other items on the agenda this week included the approval of a new translation of the Bible and a revised version of conference directives for Catholic healthcare services, which forbids transgender-related interventions given to those with gender dysphoria. Plans were also announced for the next National Eucharistic Congress, and a proposal was approved to consecrate the U.S. to the Sacred Heart of Jesus next year. New committee chairs were also elected, and the body heard from outgoing President Archbishop Timothy Broglio, who said in his time leading the conference, he learned the bishops often compete with many other voices.
That some of our faithful listen more readily to sound bites, the sirens of political discourse, or whatever confirms their conclusions and partisan leanings, than they are to hearing the pastors, their pastors, and us.
People in the pews, are they aware of the work of the USCCB? Have they heard the statements, the concerns?
That's a very good question. It's a question that we ask ourselves, you know. Is anybody reading the materials that we put out or any of the programs? But I think the conference is involved in many of the things that do impact the lives of everyday Catholics. Bishops are entrusted with teaching and governing, sanctifying in the name of Jesus Christ.
And their spiritual work brings them here each fall.
Baltimore serves as a historically important city for American Catholicism. It was here that the nation's first diocese was founded. The bishops meet here annually, and their meetings this year, perhaps even more significant, considering back in May, we got our first American Pope.
But he understands, I think, our American mindset in a way that I think is going to be helpful to us, and it's going to be attractive to many of our countrymen.
Pope Leo has shown he can connect with American culture.
He's a big fan of the Chicago White Sox, for example. I mean,
some people would disagree with
that. Well, I know. I'm not sure I agree with that either. I'm from Kansas City.
Bishop John Fulda of Fargo believes Leo's missionary spirit will help guide his pontificate.
He speaks from his experience as a missionary. He has a very, very strong sense of mission, and I think we're going to be hearing a lot about that.
And as this body of U.S. bishops rejoices in the election of the first American pope, they also welcome to their numbers new bishops Pope Leo has appointed in the U.S., including Bishop Simon Peter Ingright. Born in Uganda, he's the first native African bishop in the American mainland.
How significant is that for Catholicism in America?
I think it's very significant. Coming from Africa, we received the good news of salvation through missionaries who brought it to us. And now, being a missionary in the United States in return, I think it's a significant development.
And looking at developing challenges within society, the bishops heard a presentation on the risks and benefits of artificial intelligence, something Pope Leo has warned the world to use cautiously.
He doesn't want people to be depersonalized and marginalized. Take stock of this technology, both good and bad, and use it as a tool, but not to allow it to take over our lives or to take our attention off of one another.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
In addition to sending a special message on immigration, the U.S. bishops also announced this week a new initiative to accompany migrants who are at risk of being deported. The new initiative is called You Are Not Alone and will focus on four key areas: emergency and family support, accompaniment and pastoral care, communication of church teaching, and solidarity through prayer and public witness. The head of the Bishop's Migration Committee, Bishop Mark Seitz, says the You Are Not Alone program is necessary because of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement actions, which he says have created, quote, a situation unlike anything we've seen previously. The bishop's new program is modeled in part after a new interfaith ministry recently launched by the newly appointed bishop of San Diego. From being a child refugee himself to now leading his Southern California diocese, Bishop Michael Pham is the first U.S. bishop to be appointed by our first U.S.-born pope, Pope Leo XIV. I sat down with him in Baltimore amid the bishop's meeting to discuss his recent appointment and how being a former refugee shapes his leadership today. Here's Bishop Michael Pham on the record. Bishop Michael Pham, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for inviting me to be in this interview with you, Catherine.
Absolutely. Your appointment was one of the first actions that Pope Leo XIV took in his pontificate. What was your reaction when you realized you are the first U.S. bishop appointment from our first ever U.S.-born pope?
Well, it's such an honor to be the first bishop being appointed by our new pontiff, Pope Leo. And it was an exciting time for me on the day that I received a call from our nuncio, Cardinal Christoph Pier. Mm-hmm. And he was in Rome just a couple of days after Pope Leo being elected. So I rushed into my office and I closed my door. I didn't know what to expect. And here it goes, after 2 days, Pope Leo being elected, and I received a call from the nuncio. It was surprising. But when I picked up the phone, and Cardinal said, "Is this Michael Pham?" And I said, "Yes." Well, more concretely, as he said, "Is this Bishop Michael Pham?" And I said, "This is he." And "Are you in your office or with anybody?" Mm-hmm. I said, "No, it's just by myself." And then he said, "Well, our new Pope Leo XIV had appointed you to be a bishop of San Diego." Wow, I was so surprised. It's just a short amount of time. And I was just being consecrated as an auxiliary bishop for over a year. And here came news that Pope Leo appointed me. And at first I didn't think about was the first appointment. And it was so surprising. It was such a short time. And then this came the news, and it's such an honor for me.
Nearly 22% of San Diego's county population are people who are immigrants, including refugees who come from other countries. You yourself, you were a child refugee.
Correct.
From Vietnam.
Correct.
Can you reflect on that experience of being a child refugee, and has that uniquely equipped you for this leadership role at this time?
You know, as a refugee, escaping from Vietnam was such a difficult, challenging experience for me, just to cross the ocean and to be able to come to the United States, sponsoring by American family back in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And through that experience, I saw death in front of my face in life. Being in the United States, so I'm very grateful as a refugee being sponsored by the family in the United States, and so I'm very grateful who I am today, that being in this country, and so I'm very grateful, and seeing what people are facing today, especially our brothers and sisters of immigrants facing deportation, and the experience that I had back in Vietnam, when the government was very difficult to people who are taking away from their home and putting them in prisons, just the way how they treated people at the time, and seeing how people of immigrants here being treated by deporting them. So.
And in fact, you founded and started an interfaith ministry called FAITH. The Faith Initiative,
Correct.
Faithful Accompaniment and Trust and Hope, in which clergy and lay people accompany immigrants to their court hearings. Tell us your mindset and your mission and why you founded this, and what's the reaction to it then?
Well, when we started this, and with all different faith tradition gather together, knowing this is important to all of us as a human family. And so we came together, journeying with people in courts. It was a wonderful experience in the sense that people really thankful that we were there with them, because they came with trepidation, fear, and nervousness. And just to seeing us being there with them, they felt comfort. They felt that whatever it is, they're in God's hands. And that was a wonderful experience for us as church, to be present in the midst of difficulties of the people. It makes a big difference in people and in deportation as well.
One of the most contentious issues facing the U.S. church right now has to do about access of the sacraments for Catholic immigrants who are being detained by ICE. How critical of an issue is this right now?
It's very big issues for us that we need to be present, and we need to talk to our officials. This is the life of faith of the people, and we as ministers, priests and clergies want to be there to support and to be part of their lives and to journey with them.
Finally, Your Excellency, what would your message be then to the Trump administration right now as it comes to immigration enforcement, from your perspective, both as a child refugee yourself and now as a bishop leading immigrants?
I'm grateful for this country, for allowing me, welcoming me into this country, and I'm respecting the law that this country has for the people. But what I ask for the administration is to treat every one of us with dignity and respect and care for each other. We are a human family. We are the people that we connect together as the world. And so I hope that this administration that recognize there's human dignity and values that we all have, that God has created us in His image and likeness, that we are to care for each other, knowing that, yes, we all have, every country has laws and regulations we need to follow. But at the same time, what we ask for is to treat every one of us with respect and with dignity in our lives. And that's what I ask. Yeah.
Bishop Michael Pham of San Diego, thank you so much
thank
for your
you.
Time. Bishop Pham is our nation's first Vietnamese-American diocesan bishop. Our thanks to Bishop Pham for taking the time to speak with us in Baltimore. Stay right there. There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
It's hard to describe the hustle and the bustle here in the market. This is where the ordinary working class people of the city come.
Next, our foreign correspondent, Colin Flynn, takes us to the African country of Ghana. What Catholic priests there are doing to help the very poorest of the poor.
If you told me even when I started as a hermit or 30 years ago that I would be in a hermitage recording like blues songs, I would have laughed at you.
And after years of prayer and solitude, a Catholic hermit reaches back to his rock and roll past to create and record music recognized by the Catholic Music Awards. The story of his long faith journey coming up.
Relief operations are on the brink of collapse in the East African nation of Sudan. That's according to a warning from the United Nations Migration Agency, which says it can only reach a fraction of those impacted by what it calls the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Sudan's bloody civil war took a dangerous new turn last month when the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces seized the city of El Fasher, the last remaining stronghold of the northern Darfur region. The siege, as well as reported atrocities by the RSF, have left hundreds dead and nearly 90,000 people fleeing the city for barren displacement camps with very few resources.
The UN says its aid convoys face access restrictions and near empty warehouses. Father Diego Carbonari, a Comboni missionary in Sudan, says the Catholic Church there supports people as best it can with limited resources.
What we as church are doing is to answer to cases that people knock at our doors, ask for help, be it food, be it shelter. And we are happy to see that as church, we are able also to mobilize and to gather the solidarity of many.
Carbonari also noted his gratitude for Pope Leo's attention to Sudan. Earlier this month, the Holy Father used his Sunday Angelus to ask Catholics around the world to pray for a ceasefire and for greater aid from the international community. More than 2,000 miles to the west of Sudan, in the country of Ghana, a long-standing crushing poverty is a way of life, particularly for girls and young women who have left the agricultural north, where there is no work, to try to support themselves in southern urban areas. During a recent trip to Ghana, correspondent Colin Flynn talked to many of these so-called Kaya Ye girls. They are manual laborers, basically porters, who carry massive amounts of weight on their heads as they transport goods to and from markets. Their lives are hard. Living conditions can be brutal. But as Colin tells us, some Catholic priests are stepping up to try to bring them some hope.
The street markets here in Accra, the capital of Ghana in West Africa, are notorious. Thousands of people buying and selling, vendors shouting over each other to make a sale, and customers holding tight to their money to make every cent last. Here you can buy just about anything. Food, clothes, jewelry, furniture, electronics, everything. Trying to make a living here in the market is tough, but the most difficult job is put on the shoulders of a group of young women who struggle every single day.
They're known as the Kaye girls, or work girls, and some of them can be as young as 12 or 13 years of age. They come here to work in the markets from their villages way up in the north with the hope of making some money to bring home to their families. But the work is extremely tough, and as you'll see, their living conditions and their treatment is even worse.
Working for the vendors, the suppliers and the customers, the Kaye girls stream past us, carrying goods in the sweltering heat. Some of the girls look very young, and because they are illiterate, many don't even know what age they are. This girl tells us that she's been working here for 1 year and earns less than $3 a day.
What is your name?
My name is Rahimatu Zawa.
What age are you?
I don't know my age. I miss my family, but I have to work.
Another girl named Barakisu is 25 and has been working here for 3 years. She tells me that she starts work in the middle of the night.
I know that some of the girls just sleep on the street.
Yes.
Is that dangerous? What's that like?
Some of the girls are raped, and some even murdered.
Does that happen sometimes, rape and murder?
Yes, just over there.
As night falls over Accra, the busy market falls silent. The crowds are gone, but the girls remain. Because unlike the vendors and the sellers, they don't have a home to go to. For many of the girls, their best option is to sleep rough at a nearby bus station. There I meet 27-year-old Rahina with two of her children, an 8-year-old daughter and a 5-month-old boy. And they show me where they sleep at night.
the benches that people normally sit.
Rahina came from a village called Bulbia Wali Wali in the north of the country.
Who's here with you?
Jalil.
And what age is he?
5 months.
5 months. And your daughter here?
Maskura.
What age is Maskura?
8 years.
8 years old. How many years have you been working in the market? Have you been here for a long time?
3 months.
3 months, okay. What made you leave your home and come here to the market?
I came here to work and get money so I can go back and take care of my children.
What's the work like here? Is it difficult?
It is very difficult work for two reasons. Because of the heavy loads, and sometimes you go the whole day without getting work to do.
I know that your 8-year-old daughter works in the market as well. Was that a difficult decision?
The way I'm suffering, I do not want my child to go through the same.
So it is estimated that there are about 150 to 200 thousand of these girls working in Accra, Kumasi, Takoradi.
The Catholic Church in Ghana is trying to help, but with so many Kaye girls in the country, estimated around 200,000, it's an overwhelming problem to tackle. One of the priests who's dedicated himself to helping these girls is Spiritan Father Maxwell Atuguba. He too is from the north of the country, and so understands where these girls are coming from.
Over 99% of the Kaye girls come from the northern part of Ghana. Now the northern regions, the upper east and upper west.
Why
and
is
the
that?
Northeast.
Are they the poorest regions?
Yes, these are the poorest regions in Ghana. So it is poverty, but it's not only poverty. It is also a lack of opportunities.
Father Maxwell is taking me to the north of the country, to some of the most rural areas. To do this, we must fly from the bustling capital, Accra, to a town called Tamale.
So we've flown all the way up north to the north of Ghana, to a town called Tamale, and now we are driving to a little village called Bulbia. These are the villages where many of these girls come from. So we'll get to see the reality of why they leave and make the 900-kilometer journey down south to Accra.
And as the sun sets and the evening draws in, we arrive at the village of Bokatanya. We've come here to interview the parents of the girl we met sleeping at the bus stop by the market back in the capital.
Bulbia is a farming community, and when we were growing up, it was all we knew. There was never another way to make a living, so we don't do any other work apart from farming here. We really don't want our children to become Kaye girls, but to instead become something like teachers or another profession. But because the conditions are so tough here, we have no choice and allow them to go to the city to do Kaye work so they can support the family. Back here in the village, we just struggle.
There is no work for her here. There is no money here. She couldn't earn a living.
The next day, Father Maxwell drives me to a farm, not too far from the villages where these girls predominantly come from. Here, there are around 85 women working. Some were Kaye girls in the past who have now been rescued, and others are younger girls who were considering traveling to the cities for work, but the Spiritans convinced them to come and work here instead. And together, they dance for us, a traditional way of welcoming us. Father Maxwell takes me around the farm to show me what they call the Dream Center.
This is maize, or some other region, they call it corn. And in Ghana, it is one of the major staple food for the people.
You have the rice fields as well?
Yes.
That they get to work in. And then, did you plant all of this?
Yeah, so, well, this will help them to raise capital. Those who want to go into trading, petty trading, table trading, as they call it, and those who want to buy a sewing machine or probably go into weaving, is a platform to raise capital to build your small business. So this can happen here.
Work, learn, and earn. That's the motto of the Dream Center. So many of the young women I meet tell me the same thing. Now, for the first time, they have hope when looking to the future.
What's your dream for the future for you and your beautiful children and the whole family?
I want them to become successful and help others. That's my dream for the future.
And the amazing thing that you pick up from these young women is the incredible strength that they have. They are strong women with strong faith who tell me again and again that despite the hardships they faced, they never lost hope. In fact, that was what sustained them.
I was working, struggling, like hustling, waiting for, like, that, hoping that better days will come. That's the courage we have. God's time is the best for us. So you have to always try your best and wait for His time, like God's time to come, so that He will bless you. So maybe today is the day. Today is our day. Can't you see?
Today's our day. The empowering message that these girls are now believing in. In Ghana, West Africa, Cullum Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
If you are interested in seeing more reporting from Cullum's trip to Ghana, he is working on a full documentary about this trip to air on EWTN in December. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Finally, an end to the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Two major items from the U.S. Supreme Court and a revival of faith at the National Catholic Youth Conference. A preview ahead.
Now to sign this incredible bill and get our country working again. Thank you.
With that signature, a record-breaking shutdown came to an end. President Trump signed a stopgap spending bill late Wednesday night in the Oval Office, ensuring government funding through the end of January. But as millions of Americans breathe a sigh of relief that the government is up and running, the legislation only kicks the can down the road. And if Republicans and Democrats cannot come to an agreement, the government could shut down again. The end of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history tops the Week in Review. This short-term funding means federal employees furloughed or fired during the shutdown can return to work. Essential workers can start receiving back pay, and food stamps for millions of Americans will be funded through the 2026 fiscal year. But to the frustration of Democratic lawmakers, the bill does not include an extension on Affordable Care Act subsidies, which expire on New Year's Eve. The House of Representatives narrowly advanced the legislation to Trump's desk Wednesday night, their first time in session in more than 8 weeks. But the drawn-out stalemate between Republicans and Democrats had its major breakthrough late last Sunday when eight moderate senators, to the ire of their peers, broke away from other Democrats who refused to support a bill unless it extended the subsidies. Senate Majority Leader John Thune promised a mid-December vote on an extension in exchange for Democratic support to reopen the government, but did not guarantee Republicans would support such a measure. Though some lawmakers expressed relief the government is open, Democratic members promised the fight over the subsidies is not over.
I'm proud of that achievement, but I'm really sad that it took us so long to get here. It was so much pain that had to be endured to get to this point. Voters are going to remember which political party played games with their lives.
Either Republicans finally decide to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits this year, or the American people will throw Republicans out of their jobs next year.
Democratic representatives plan to force a vote on the subsidies extension, which they hope will pressure swing district Republicans to support the measure. And as the government sprang back to life, the more than 800,000 citizens of Arizona's 7th congressional district finally were represented again in Congress. After a seven-week delay, Representative Adelita Grivalha was sworn in as the district's new congresswoman. And the government's reopening means millions of Americans will once again receive food stamps through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins promised benefits will be fully restored by Monday. Recipients in some states receive their food stamps as early as Thursday. Others will see the benefits hit their EBT card this weekend. SNAP is the largest federal food program. 1 in 8 Americans rely on it to feed their families. Despite the end of the shutdown, travelers should not expect airport disruptions to calm down anytime soon. Over the past week, more than 9,000 flights have been canceled and many more delayed after the Federal Aviation Administration ordered airlines to reduce flights at the nation's busiest airports, a move meant to ease the workload of control towers that were short-staffed during the shutdown. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said flight reductions at those airports would hold at 6% until the FAA decides it is safe to resume more flights. Passengers across the country are frustrated by cancellations and delays.
I'm exhausted. I am tired. I am mad. I had to call the customer service. They couldn't give me anything. I'm tired. I just want to sleep. It's not okay.
Where I've traveled before, I've never had this kind of problem. And like I said, for people my age, 73 years old, and I'm sitting out in the cold in a wheelchair waiting.
Airlines warn it could be days before air travel returns to normal. Canceled flights mean rerouted planes are not where they're supposed to be, and controllers could wait weeks to receive their back pay. But Thanksgiving travel will likely be unaffected. The Supreme Court has rejected a challenge to its decision in Obergefell versus Hodges, the 2015 case that redefined marriage and legalized single-sex unions. The justices declined the case without comment on Monday. Former County Clerk Kim Davis of Kentucky brought the case to the Supreme Court after a near decade-long legal battle. In 2015, shortly after the High Court issued its decision in Obergefell, Davis refused to issue a marriage license to a same-sex couple because of her religious beliefs. She has recently asked the justices to not only overturn its original decision, but also to reverse a lower court order that requires her to pay the same-sex couple $300,000 in court fees. Legal expert Thomas Jipping said the court was unlikely to take on Davis's case.
She was acting as a public official, and the First Amendment applies differently with regard to the actions of public officials than private individuals. You'd have to have a legislature pass a law banning same-sex marriage. That would conflict with the Supreme Court's precedent in Obergefell. And then the Supreme Court would have to decide whether to revisit Obergefell as a precedent.
After the conservative justices overturned Roe versus Wade in 2022, many court watchers wondered if they would do the same to Obergefell. Justice Clarence Thomas had even suggested in an opinion the court should reexamine the landmark ruling. But his colleagues have hinted they are not as eager to tackle the issue. In another action this week, the High Court agreed to hear a major election law case that will determine whether mail-in ballots must be received by Election Day. The Republican National Committee is challenging a Mississippi law that allows ballots to be counted as long as they are postmarked by Election Day and arrive within 5 business days. That would include ballots cast by American military members and their families who are stationed abroad. The challengers say all ballots must arrive no later than Election Day to be valid. 30 other states and the District of Columbia have laws similar to the one in Mississippi. A ruling is expected by early summer, with enough time to impact how the 2026 midterm elections are conducted. We are less than 1 week away now from Pope Leo's first digital encounter, a historic dialogue between the Holy Father and American teens at the National Catholic Youth Conference. The conference has announced the young people who will speak directly with Pope Leo from Indianapolis. More than 40 young people helped to plan the upcoming dialogue, and five of them will speak directly with the Holy Father during the encounter. That group includes Mia Smothers, a high school freshman from Joppa, Maryland, who hopes the dialogue will show her nine siblings the joy of knowing and loving God, and Ezekiel Ponce, a senior from Downey, California. He shared his excitement about speaking with Leo during a virtual pre-conference gathering this week.
Honestly, it means the absolute world to me. Like, it's an honor and a great privilege to get to talk to the Holy Father. And honestly, it makes me feel like my voice is heard. And it makes me feel like the youth of America voice is heard.
This live digital encounter will be the first time the Pope will directly engage with U.S. youth in this manner. More than 15,000 teens will be in attendance in Lucas Oil Stadium, and hundreds of thousands more from around the world will be able to watch live through the EWTN network. We are joined by an NCYC volunteer who is passionate about youth ministry and will be very actively involved at the conference, getting the word out digitally to young people on social media. Tanya Vergara Gangora is a student at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky, and is an NCYC 2025 event ambassador. Tanya, thanks for being with us. First, how are you and the NCYC team feeling in this one-week countdown until Pope Leo's first digital visit with American young people?
Yeah, it's been so overwhelmingly positive. I was actually reflecting with my mom last night that I didn't realize until this past Tuesday when we had the pre-event gathering with NFCYM and the NCYC team that how historic and monumental this encounter truly is going to be. And I've just been like, I need to share this with everyone. And I've never felt this overwhelming sense in my life. And my mom, like always, she always finds the perfect words and was like, Tanya, your heart is on fire for the Lord in the last few days. And I'm like, I have no other way to describe that. And I am very sure that anyone, that everyone that is not only involved in this planning of the event, but just anyone in general that is looking forward to attending NCYC in person with us or joining us virtually for this encounter with Pope Leo.
And to imagine, you know, 15,000 teens who are also on fire for the Lord coming together. Tanya, can you give us a sense of what it is that American young people are especially struggling with today? What topics do you expect will come up in the discussion with Pope Leo?
Yes, so I was actually speaking with my youth ministry last night, shout out San Bernadette with the Archdiocese of Louisville, that one of the things that as youth we're really struggling is with the power of social media. Mm-hmm. It is such a positive and crazy thing, but it has really made our world so fast-paced because of how fast information is accessible. Mm-hmm. And because we have so much access, it has sort of led to us becoming numb to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And having like false idols, lots of peer pressure, and just trying to live up to what we see through these digital platforms. Mm-hmm. So for the Pope to be encountering us through the digital platforms that we are struggling with, I think personally, it's just so special. Mm,
that's a great observation. And Tanya, this is not your first papal encounter. 3 years ago, you traveled in a group to Rome to meet with Pope Francis, and you delivered him a message from the American youth. Tanya, can you just reflect on that experience and how this upcoming encounter with Pope Leo makes this truly a full circle moment for you?
Yes. Well, I was so fortunate in 2022 to, along with the National Youth Advisory Council, be invited to receive a message of joy to bring back to the youth of NCYC 2022. And that year, we made him a friendship bracelet that I got to put on him, that one of the colors that the bracelet had was yellow. And yellow actually symbolizes joy. And we didn't know that that was the message that he was going to give us. I mean, only God knew that. So that was truly special. And then I got to share this with him in Spanish, my first language. But my first encounter with Pope Francis was actually at NCYC 2019, my first NCYC, where he surprised everyone with a virtual video message telling the youth to go forth and be disciples of Christ. So NCYC has truly meant so much to me, not only in my first NCYC in 2019, being able to experience a message from Pope Francis as a youth, but then in 2022, receiving it from him in person and bringing it to the youth. And now this year, being able to receive another message, but broadcasting it from the youth. And one of the things that I think is so special that I when preparing for this, I wanted to emphasize what we told Pope Francis in 2022 that we asked of him was that he meet us through these digital platforms. And this encounter with Pope Leo is testimony and witness that the church hears us.
That's
our
beautiful.
Pope sees us and is meeting us exactly where we asked him for him to meet us. And because it's going to be digital, anyone will be able to have this encounter.
Well, on that note, Tanya, I just have, you know, about 30 seconds with you left, but can you just share some ideas for those who can't physically be there in Lucas Oil Stadium, how they can still participate in NCYC?
Yes, because it's going to be digital, it's going to be on all streaming platforms brought to you by EWTN, on YouTube, on cable. You can register on the NCYC page for pre and post content. It's going to be literally just Google it and you'll have access to it. And you can tune in live next Friday, November 21st at 10:15 a.m. Eastern time. And I hope to see all of you guys either there or joining us virtually.
Well, Tanya, I feel your excitement from here. We're all praying for the event and we'll all be tuning in. Tanya, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And as Tanya said, you will not want to miss Pope Leo's historic digital encounter with the youth, which will take place on Friday, November 21st at 10:15 a.m. Eastern. EWTN will exclusively broadcast the dialogue live from Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. Catch it on TV, in the app, or on our social media platforms. And that's just one part of our daily live coverage of NCYC, starting on Thursday, November 20th, and ending on Saturday, November 22nd. Find the schedule at EWTN.com/TV. And it is with gratitude that we honor the life of Sister Mary Michael of the Eucharistic Heart of Jesus, the last of the five original nuns who founded Our Lady of Angels Monastery in Alabama with EWTN foundress Mother Angelica. She died Monday at the age of 94. In the early 1960s, Sister Michael agreed to move from Canton, Ohio to Alabama with Mother Angelica and three others. Over the decades, she showed fidelity to the mission with each of Mother Angelica's new inspirations to evangelize. Dedicated to a cloistered life of prayer, she inspired vocations and served her community for several terms as vicar and counselor. Just days before her death, Sister Mary Michael urged followers of Christ to keep doing what you are doing, so we can be one big family in heaven. Eternal rest grant unto Sister Mary Michael, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon her. Next, the faith journey of a hermit priest, bringing the eternal word to his listeners through the gift of music.
The King of Kings with his Queen Mother, the Lord of Lords, our friend and brother, with angels and saints, on he goes to victory against the infernal foe.
The life of a hermit priest is a quiet one. Away from the hustle and bustle of the world, he can dedicate himself entirely to prayer. You would not expect this vocation filled with silence to inspire rock music. But when one hermit felt the Holy Spirit calling him to use his musical gifts he first cultivated as a teenager, he once again picked up the electric guitar to share his music with the world. Catherine Rabano brings us Father Maximilian Mary Dean's faith journey in depth.
In the rolling farm country of southern Pennsylvania, a still and peaceful quiet echoes for miles. For Father Maximilian Mary Dean, a hermit with the Diocese of Harrisburg, that quiet atmosphere is perfect for his life of prayer.
You don't have to schedule silence when you're in the hermitage. It is silent.
As a hermit, Father Dean has devoted his life to the praise of God and the salvation of souls, and lives in solitude, away from the world. Each day he says Mass, recites the Rosary, and prays the Liturgy of the Hours. And from that contemplative vocation, a joyful noise rings out. Here in the St. Joseph Hermitage, Father Dean writes and records his music. From instruments to a recording booth and a digital audio workstation, he has everything he needs to build his songs layer by layer.
So gentle and so sweet.
It all happens right here.
Father Dean's music combines the timeless wisdom and beauty of the faith with a contemporary sound.
And I haven't listened to secular pop music, rock music since 1988. So without any effort, my music sounds vintage because all my influences are pre-1988, the 70s and 80s. So I just kind of run with it.
His latest song, The Lord's Will is Most Beautiful, is steeped in that vintage sound and inspired by a poem.
It's this beautiful poem about how God is, through our life, is trying to weave this masterpiece of union with Him, and how we see the underside, which if you ever look at a tapestry, like all the frayed strings, it doesn't make sense, but He sees the upper side.
In Father Dean's own life, it's clear to see how the Lord weaved music throughout his faith journey. He says his love for music began as a young boy in the 70s, listening to the radio in the back seat of his parents' car.
From 9, I was on the piano. 10, I had my first guitar and started playing in like rock bands with kids from school.
By high school, he played guitar in a successful rock band.
We had a booking agent, so we were gigging almost every weekend.
While that band left Indianapolis to pursue fame, Dean stayed behind to finish high school, but he soon started to notice an emptiness in his life.
Kind of towards the end of high school, I had this big void in my life, this emptiness, so I knew there had to be something more.
It's you that I want, you that I need, for you I need you to lead.
Though a baptized Catholic, it had been years since Dean had attended Mass. He questioned whether God existed at all. A high school friend encouraged him to pray.
I go to Rebecca, and I'm just like, Rebecca, how do you know God exists? And she goes, well, you just have to pray. From that day, literally from that day to now, I've prayed every day of my life.
That led him to experience a major conversion during his freshman year at DePaul University in Chicago. He continued to develop that faith and soon felt God might be calling him to the priesthood. He left his classical guitar studies at DePaul and transferred to the Franciscan University of Steubenville, Ohio, to study philosophy. In 2000, he was ordained a priest with the Franciscan Friars of the Immaculate. In 2017, Father Dean made his solemn vows as a hermit with the Diocese of Harrisburg. And in this life of solitude, he felt God calling him to use those gifts he first learned as a teenager.
And then 2019, I started like receiving these songs, and they weren't like, they were kind of like 70s pop music songs. It's hard to explain. And after I received two or three of them, I realized that I think our Lord might be calling me to record again. And the thing is that I, without me even really being aware of it, that the landscape of music has changed so much that I can actually record and mix and produce a song here in my hermitage.
I water in the spirit, I am born again.
His music serves a different purpose from the hymns and traditional chants heard at Mass, instead providing a soundtrack for listeners as they go about their day-to-day lives.
If you're having a barbecue or you're driving to work or you just need some music that has a beat that's captivating, and yet if you listen to the words, it's going to lead you closer to Christ and a deeper love for your neighbor.
Father Dean has released 5 albums so far from his hermitage. He averages more than 500,000 streams a year from more than 60,000 listeners. Occasionally, Father Dean will even travel to perform his music live.
The other 345 or 350 days of the year, I'm here in the hermitage. That's what they don't see, necessarily.
Though rock music may seem at odds with the eremitical life, Father Dean and all contemplatives are called to both pray and work.
Monasteries and hermits alike, they have to be self-sustaining, so they have to do some kind of work that can also help them sustain their way of life. I make music, and that's my work period.
As a hermit, he doesn't often see the impact of his music.
And so I don't always see or hear, but sometimes I do, little tidbits, and I don't need that, but it does help to confirm that what I'm doing is God's work, it's God's will.
He hopes it helps people on their spiritual journey.
I pray every day in my Mass, I pray for all those, I call it my music family, and I don't know who they are and who they will be, but I'm praying that for them, but also that God will work through the music to touch and bless them.
In Ortana, Pennsylvania, I'm Catherine Urbano, EWTN News in Depth.
What a powerful reminder that God can use all of our talents and gifts for his glory. You can watch our full report about Father Maximilian on our EWTN News YouTube page. We continue now our musical focus as we bring our program to a close with highlights from this week's annual International Festival of Sacred Music and Art in Rome. At various venues, including the Papal Basilica's world-renowned musical ensembles, performed selections from some of the most famous musical literature of all time. We present a small sampling from 3 evenings of music that attracted musical fans from all around the globe. From the EWTN Vatican Bureau, enjoy our images of the week. And on that note, that's a wrap of this edition on EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Next week, instead of this program, we are going to bring you coverage of the National Catholic Youth Conference in Indianapolis, the event where Pope Leo will make a digital visit to American teens. Be sure to tune in. Until we see you again, God bless.